This show is brought to you by Gobble by Kevin Carr, a Thanksgiving novelette of the zombie apocalypse, and you thought your family dinner was stressful. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's new movies I'm going to be talking about is this little independent film called Star Wars: The Last Jedi, Ferdinand, and The Shape of Water. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, a listener question, and the box office, as well as the home cinema roundup featuring the trip to Spain. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The big piece of news that is actually hitting a lot of businesses, not just movies or television, is the merger between Disney and a portion of Fox. And it's really kind of hard to break this down because these are both two huge companies. Now, first of all, what you got to realize, it's not all of Fox. It's not like they're buying everything that Fox offers. They're buying like its international business. And the big move is buying the entertainment sections of it. So sort of like news, so like Fox News Channel and associated properties are still with Fox. And the sports is all still with Fox. And that's kind of where Fox wants to focus on, I'm assuming, news and sports. The entertainment side, meaning the 21st century Fox entertainment, which is the movies, which is the television segment, meaning the scripted television segment. Those are all being proposed to being unloaded into Disney. Now, there's a lot of feelings by a lot of people on this. So obviously this still has to go through antitrust and approval from the SEC, which may not happen. That absolutely may not happen. And I don't necessarily think that the approval or the SEC is going to torpedo this deal because of the movies or television. And I'll talk about that in a second. I think if it has a chance of torpedoing anything else, it's going to be the conglomeration of businesses and how other things and elements conflict with what Disney already owns. Because, of course, Fox, as a corporation, still will own plenty of stuff. This is not like when Disney bought Lucasfilm. Disney bought Lucasfilm and just absorbed the whole thing. Or when they bought Pixar, they absorbed the whole thing. Or when they bought Marvel, they absorbed the whole thing. They're absorbing potentially part of Fox. And where I think that the problem might lie is with the other businesses and how much of the market share they have in other businesses. They might have to carve out elements of it in this merger. The big thing that causes interest on my side of the coin is the movies and television stuff. Now, the television stuff, I don't know, it's weird anyways with television because it's not uncommon for a show to be produced by Fox, for example, and to be aired on ABC or vice versa. A Modern Family is a great example of that. I believe it's produced by Warner Brothers. And it airs on ABC. So you have this weird mixing of ownership anyways. And the reason I don't think this is going to bust up any antitrust problems is because there's plenty of other studios out there. You can't say that Disney owns all the movie rights because you still have Sony. You still have Warner Brothers. You still have Lionsgate. Now, a lot of people have been concerned because of the Marvel thing. And I think this is one of the reasons Disney wanted to go after this because but it's not the sole reason. I mean, they're paying like $50 to $70 billion for this. You're going to have a lot of Avengers movies made to make up that $50 to $70 billion if your only reason to do this is to get Wolverine and Hulk to fight on the big screen. So, but from a movie perspective, I've heard concerns because people are going, oh, they're going to move the X-Men out of Fox and it's going to become part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And there's sort of that hipster culture that's like turns its nose up at that because it's too mainstream. And same thing with Fantastic Four. Now, I mean, there still are rights issues that have to work out, but ultimately with the right to distribute these movies, Disney would be able to weave them into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Heck, they were able to do a Spider-Man, and that's still being produced by another company. Now, the reason I'm okay with this is you already have Warner Brothers, which owns all of DC. Every single DC character is owned by Warner Brothers. They should have been doing this decades ago, but they haven't. This will not be a monopoly of superhero characters because Disney owns all the superheroes. They already own the characters in Marvel, and they now can get the distribution rights to them. It's just that they're the only ones doing it well. And that's not a reason to say it's a monopoly. Just because Disney is very, very good at brand recognition with Marvel and Pixar and Disney Princess and Star Wars does not mean that other people can't make movies. Disney's not stopping Warner Brothers from making a coherent, great Justice League movie. Warner Brothers is standing in its own way from doing that. It's a leadership issue. And that's why I'm not bothered as much from the movie perspective. I mean, sure, maybe on business perspective, there's going to be issues with it. But from a movie or television perspective, I don't think it's right to punish Disney because they just know what they're doing. Warner Brothers is kind of been incompetent with the DC Cinematic Universe itself. That's not Disney's fault. Disney's just doing its thing, and Warner Brothers is trying to replicate it and not doing a good job at it. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the trailer park. The first movie I want to talk about is Annihilation. The new trailer dropped this week.
It's something they termed the Shimmer. We've sent in drones and teams of people,
but nothing comes back.
But something has.
The boundary's getting bigger, it's expanding.
You need to know what's inside.
So do I. What is it?
The soldiers on the last expedition.
They went crazy. Or something in here killed them.
Something's come through the fence.
Through the fence?
I actually saw this trailer in front of a movie. I forget what it was. It might have been Happy Death Day. And this looks interesting. It's directed by the guy and written and adapted by the guy who did Ex Machina, which is a great film. It's a really good movie, a great sci-fi movie. It wasn't as good as everybody said it was. I mean, I think there was a lot of love for Ex Machina that forgave some real problematic science elements to it, just because it was meant to be a cerebral science fiction piece. But then when you get too cerebral with a science fiction piece, you end up building your own roadblocks that you have trouble getting around. But Ex Machina was a great movie, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with this. I get a real sense that this feels a lot like The Arrival, or at least it's trying to position itself to be like The Arrival. I don't think you're going to get the same thing because Denis Villeneuve is a very different director, but still, I'm curious to see this. It's science fiction. It looks good. It opens in February, which may not be that might be a little troubling, but we'll see. The next one I want to talk about really quickly is Alita Battle Angel, and that opens on July 20th.
Does it bother you that I'm not completely human? I'd do whatever I had to for you. I'd give you whatever I have. I'd give you my heart.
Alita, they will come for you.
Why?
I think you are someone very special.
This is going to run into the same problems that a lot of sort of anime or anime-inspired movies run into. I don't know anything about the source material about this, but this feels like an anime kind of movie, and I'm sure it's going to run into the same problems that movies like Ghost in the Shell run into. That narrow group of people who are huge anime fans and manga fans are very hard to please, and their response to Ghost in the Shell or Death Note is a great example of that. And so part of it, it's directed by Robert Rodriguez, and I think he hasn't made a smart film in more than a dozen years. I mean, I thought like the original Sin City was a fantastic movie, but then he was doing movies like Shorts and some of his later stuff has not been very good. So we'll see. It looks neat. It might look like it has some neat stuff happening visually, but you never know. This could be a complete stinker. That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Ferdinand and the Shape of Water. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the new movies that are out this week. Well, one of them's brand new, and that would be Ferdinand. A bull in Spain grows to immense size but refuses to do battle in the bullfighting ring.
Who's my good boy?
Hey, I thought I was the good boy.
I am here to select a bull. My hands are my instruments, as are my arms, legs, chest, and buttocks.
Nope, I'll pass, thanks. You guys go ahead. Let's go out there and give it 110%.
Woohoo! Smash him in the head!
Actually, I'm gonna pass on the violence.
You finally ready to fight? Come on!
I am not a fighting bull.
What's funny is when I went to go see the screening for this, they gave away these little headband you wear in your head for the kids. I brought my 9-year-old son, and he got one of these. It's horns. And I took a picture of myself. I put it on social media. And a friend of mine, actually an old girlfriend, she's not a teacher now, but she went to school to be an educator. And I believe she works in Christian education now. She's like in the ministry. But she was an elementary education major in college. And I know she's worked with kids all her life. And she's a big fan of reading. And she sent me a message on Facebook. And she's like, the book Ferdinand is near sacred. And I wrote back and I said, hey, look, I just review the movies. They don't listen to me. And it wasn't until then that I really realized how pervasive and well-known the book is. I remember the book. I believe it was read to me when I was in grade school. I'm sure it was. I haven't read the book in decades, so I don't remember as much. But knowing the source material for movies like The Lorax, picture books are short by their very nature. They don't have very many words in them, hence the name picture book. And a picture book is not long enough to adapt into a full movie. And we certainly saw that with movies like The Polar Express, where it's a charming little book, but then they just added so much garbage into The Polar Express that means nothing and does nothing to propel any sort of story or characters, that it's 90% filler. Or if you take a movie like The Lorax, which is a great book and very poignant and makes a statement, but it's not exactly a well-plotted book. There's not like depth of characters and a character arc or anything like that. It's more of a presentation book, which is completely normal in picture books. And then when they made the movie, they just added all this garbage in there that just kind of got in the way of the story. And that's the thing with Ferdinand. There's a lot of stuff added to Ferdinand. Now it's cute. It's done by the people who did they're Blue Sky. They're the guys who do the Ice Age movies. These movies do tend to make tons and tons and tons of money overseas. You can kind of see the sort of purity of heart not quite there in Ferdinand. The book's about pacifism is really what it's about. It's about not fighting when you don't have to. It's about, in fact, taking a knee and not fighting. And your strongest move in a potential fight is to do nothing. It's about pacifism. And the movie's kind of like that, but it's almost kind of thrown in. The climax of the book's in there. But it feels like it's just kind of tossed in at the end. And ultimately, it's padded out with a lot of fart jokes and cute animals that were never in the book in the first place and action slapstick scenes that work fine as a kid's movie, but kind of cheapen what the original book was. So, I mean, if you just want to see a movie with your kids and it's an animated cartoon and you want to hear John Cena as a bull, yeah, it works. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks just because I'm being nice because it's Christmas time. But it just barely kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Shape of Water. This has been hard to figure out when I'm going to cover it because it's doing this weird expansion and it expands this week in my hometown of Columbus, Ohio. But it's not going to open nationwide till next week, but it's in enough cities that it's really getting a lot of play. It also, it's getting a lot of award buzz, an insane amount of award buzz. A lot, I've heard people compare it to like The Revenant, where it kind of comes out of nowhere and suddenly starts gobbling up all these nominations. So I think it's worth talking about now. Guillermo del Toro directs this love story between a mute woman and a gill man creature discovered in South America.
She deaf?
Mute, sir. She can hear you.
You clean that lab, you get out.
This may very well be the most sensitive asset ever to be housed in this facility.
You may think that thing looks human. Stands on two legs, right?
This creature is intelligent, capable of language, of understanding emotions.
The origins of this movie, I believe, come from the fact that Guillermo del Toro was originally in talks to develop a Creature from the Black Lagoon movie for Universal, for their still attempting to reboot the Universal Monster series. But Guillermo del Toro, being himself, he decided to take it a different direction. He wanted to take it kind of from the perspective of the Gill Man, which is kind of a good 21st century way of looking at it. Because if you watch the original Creature from the Black Lagoon, there is an overbearing man over nature sort of message to that movie, that we can do whatever we want to these creatures. And that continues in the two sequels that they had, which aren't nearly as good as the original movie. Not that Creature from the Black Lagoon is great. I mean, I think of all of the original monsters, it's one of the weakest ones, and it came out in the 50s, long after the heyday of the 30s and the 40s of the Universal Monster films. But Guillermo del Toro wanted to make it from his point of view, and Universal wasn't having that, so I think he just kind of took the project to Fox Searchlight and just did it himself, and just kind of made a Gillman-like thing, and he found it in South America, and the character's played by Doug Jones, not the guy who won the Alabama Senate race, but the actor who's in movies like Falling Skies and Star Trek Discovery, and he played in all of Guillermo del Toro's stuff. He's a real tall, thin actor, wonderful guy. I've actually met the guy. He's a sweetheart of a man and deserves all the praise that he gets for this movie. So the story hinges on Sally Hawkins as this woman who, she's mute, and so she has a bit of a troubled past. She has violence in her past. And she's living with, platonically, with Richard Jenkins, who's an artist whose livelihood is disappearing because art is going the way of the dodo in favor of photography. So it has a certain relevance to dying industries we see today, like print newspapers and taxi drivers and anything like that. The Shape of Water is a beautifully done movie. It does get a little heavy-handed with the messaging, but I think part of that is Guillermo del Toro playing off the 50s, because that's when this movie takes place. And Michael Shannon plays a great bad guy who is a bit of a zealot. He plays a great bad guy. Sally Hawkins just knocks it out of the park without an actual spoken line at all in the movie. This is a tender, sweet, beautiful movie that is not afraid to kind of get under your skin a little bit and show things that you might immediately think is uncomfortable or taboo. There's some stuff in the movie that I was kind of, well, it's kind of shocking. And you have to think about why del Toro included that. And I think he did for very specific reasons. And ultimately, that's what makes this movie so good, is because there are layers to it, not just story and character, but his choice to show things that break the norms of a movie. You would have never seen a movie like this in the 50s. You would have never seen things happening in this movie. You would have never seen somebody fall in love with a monster. You would have never seen a mute woman as the star who has no lines whatsoever. And you never see a woman who looks like Sally Hawkins, who's a very pretty woman, but she's not model gorgeous. And you never see some of the things that they show in this movie that I really can't even talk about on the radio, because it is R-rated and it has sex. It has some violence in it, but it's probably one of the most artistic movies that Guillermo del Toro has done since he did Pan's Labyrinth, and probably has the most nuanced message in it as well. I mean, it's not like, you know, Pacific Rim, which was just a lot of fun rock 'em sock 'em robots. This one, it's about beauty in unexpected forms. And I'm going to say that Shape of Water totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to talk about this little independent film you may have heard of called Star Wars: The Last Jedi.
We're
Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The big movie this week is the latest Star Wars film, Star Wars The Last Jedi. Have you heard of this one? And before we actually start with the review, I want to introduce my son, Nicholas Carr. Say hello.
Hi.
Now, how old are you, Nick?
I'm 9.
You had to think about that?
No.
You did. You said in front of it.
Well, that's because I was thinking if I should do 9 years, 5 months.
Nobody cares about months once you get to about 10. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I don't tell people that I'm 46 in 3 months or something like that. Nobody cares about that. Nobody cares about the months at a certain point.
Okay.
You're 9, and that's significant because I was 9 when Empire Strikes Back came out.
You what?
Yeah, I was only 9 years old when that came out. So I thought it would be neat specifically talking to you because not only 8, you got to see the movie.
Yeah.
Well, that was cool.
Yeah.
You got to go early.
I even have my lightsaber beside me.
That's right. You had a lightsaber and you had a BB-8 and we didn't have a Porg yet, but we might want to get one of those sometime. Did you brag to all your friends that you got to see it early?
I told my best friend, Elliot.
And what'd he say? Was he jealous? Let's just go ahead and play the trailer. While Finn, Poe, and General Leia Organa are on the run from the relentless First Order Battalion, Rey tries to learn Jedi techniques from Luke Skywalker that can help her face off against Kylo Ren and Supreme Leader Snoke.
I've seen this raw strength only once before. It didn't scare me enough then. It does now.
Die. Kill it. That's the only way to become what you were meant to be.
Before I go into my detail and minutia, I want to get the 9-year-old's impression of this movie and how it fits in with all the other ones. Now, no spoilers, of course.
That's going to be hard.
Well, don't tell people, like, surprises that happen or something, you know, if something you weren't expecting. You can talk about it in general.
Oh, I think it's really good. I don't think it deserves to be PG-13.
Oh, you didn't like the idea that it was PG-13?
Yeah, because there was barely any blood.
Well, yeah, but I mean, people die in this movie.
Yeah.
It's a little violent at times.
Something that I didn't like when you mentioned is that this is like the second movie Snoke has been in.
Yeah.
I thought he was just a gigantic person.
Well, that's because he was just in a projection from Force Awakens. You didn't know how big he was.
Yeah.
He could have been as big as one of the Porgs. Wouldn't that be hilarious when they finally reveal Snoke? He's as big as a Porg.
Yeah.
And a Porg just comes and sits on him or something like that. That'd be a nice little alternate take on the thing. But you liked it.
Yes.
Okay. Now, here's the thing, because the movie's 2.5 hours long. So it's longer than I think all the other ones. I can't remember how long Revenge of the Sith was, but I think that's the longest one. Did you think it ran too long?
No. I think they had really good details, and I think they should have put those details
in. You like the fact that they added stuff in this in the characters, and because the way this one works, and this summer we watched all the Star Wars movies together.
Yes.
And one of the things that people only like my age understand is what it was like going to see Empire Strikes Back in the theaters. And there's a lot of unresolved stuff. They're going for another movie, obviously.
Yeah.
And you and I this summer, what did we do? We just put in Return of the Jedi and watched it. We didn't have to wait. Yeah. You know, we didn't have to sit there and like bellyache for 2 years. We got to wait 2 years until there's another movie for this, right?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that kind of sucks about it, doesn't it?
Yeah. However, isn't there going to be a story about Han Solo?
Yes, there will be Solo, and that comes out early next year. But that's going to be like Rogue One, where it's separate and it takes place before Episode 4.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the one thing, and I say that as a note about this movie, not as a criticism, really, because this movie should have unresolved issues, but it is sort of like watching the end of Empire Strikes Back, where you're like, oh, no, we're waiting for the conclusion, but we have to wait. You just can't put in the next disc.
Yeah.
That's the biggest challenge. And if you notice, they patterned it after Empire Strikes Back to a degree where they split the characters up. You know, Rey goes off. We knew that because
at the end of
Force Awakens.
Yeah.
She's there handing a lightsaber to Luke, and he's just staring at her going, what? You know, what? And, you know, he's been a hermit for a while. And then, of course, you've got Leia on the run with all the other rebels or the resistance.
Yeah.
With the First Order coming after him. And that's very much like in Empire Strikes Back, where Han Solo and Princess Leia and Chewbacca and C-3PO were on the run from the Empire, while Luke and R2-D2, they were off with Yoda.
Yeah. How far, how many years apart is it the sixth and seventh movie? Because it's got to be a lot of years.
It's something like
Leia
30.
Looks like. Well,
she's older. And, you know, because she's, and Luke's older. And Han Solo in Force Awakens, he's a lot older now. See, say Force Awakens was made in 2015. Return of the Jedi was made in 1983, which is 32 years before that. So it's been, I think the timeline's about the same. It's like 30-some years later.
You had to wait a long time.
I know. Well, we had the prequels in the middle of them. Did you like the prequels, though? As a kid who watched the prequels, do you like the prequels, or are you going to be like a hipster who's like, you don't like the prequels anymore because I'm a hipster?
I don't really know what prequels are.
The 1, 2, and 3 with Anakin Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah.
The ones with Padme. We have our own private car family joke about Padme, which we won't go into in the radio show. Do you like the prequels? Do you like the first 3, 1, 2, and 3?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's interesting about this movie is they give a lot more characterization, especially to the new characters.
Yeah.
And you saw they started doing this in The Force Awakens, where it was simultaneously a brand new story with Rey and Finn and Poe. But at the same time, it worked with nostalgia, like thinking of the past with Carrie Fisher as Princess Leia and Harrison Ford as Han Solo. And you have Chewbacca in there as well. This one gives you a lot more depth into the new characters. You learn a lot more about Rey, mm-hmm. Kylo Ren.
Yeah.
And not as much about a Finn or Poe, really. And there's a little bit of nostalgia where like the first movie, Force Awakens, was Han Solo's movie. Yeah. This one's a little more Luke and Leia.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, because we all know what happens with Han Solo. But Luke and Leia in this movie, it's sort of like their movie. Did you like Carrie Fisher's? This is her final role. This is the last film she made before she died.
Which one's Carrie Fisher?
Leia.
Oh. Yeah.
You think she did a good job?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't think her character was just thrown in there to appease fans or anything like that?
No.
Okay, yeah. I really enjoyed it. I thought, was there enough action to it? They didn't have the massive action scenes. They had a couple of them, but they didn't have the massive, like, 20-minute Death Star attack type scenes.
Yeah, or a huge lightsaber scene.
No, they're all... The action, that's the one thing I did notice, the action was kind of scattered throughout in smaller bits and chunks.
Yeah.
But I still thought it was really good. I mean, I really thought that the action worked, and I'm looking forward to seeing the next one. Are you looking forward to seeing the next one?
Yep.
Which was your favorite character in this movie?
Kylo Ren,
because you went as Kylo Ren for Halloween?
Not necessarily, because I'm kind of on the good side, but I don't know
You're kind of on the good side? I gotta have a talk with your mother.
I don't know.
Okay. You know what was my favorite credit in this movie? When we watched the ending credits, you know what was my favorite? Do you remember?
No.
Oh. No. I had to remove that because that's also a little bit of a spoiler. Peter Mayhew was the original Chewbacca. He's the guy who was in the Chewbacca costume in the first 3 movies. He has the credit of Chewbacca consultant in this movie. I think every company should have a Chewbacca consultant.
I thought Chewbacca consultant was that little guy.
No, Peter Mayhew's really tall.
Oh!
Because he's gotten old. He's really old, too. So he's not doing Chewbacca anymore. They got another guy playing Chewbacca. But they have Peter Mayhew because he's still around. And he's giving him pointers on how to play Chewbacca, I'm assuming. I think they should have a Chewbacca consultant. You know, everything. The Walmart should have a Chewbacca consultant in every store. I think like Nationwide Insurance.
Actually, I saw... In real life, a house that had a stormtrooper
yeah.
and Darth Vader. on their fun nong.
Wow. Well, they obviously didn't have a Chewbacca consultant because there was no Chewbacca there. Yeah. All right, so we got to give our final grade. What's your final grade on Star Wars The Last Jedi?
Completely rocks.
I'm going to also say completely rocks as well.
It rocks.
Excellent.
And that is it. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be taking a listener question and talking about the weekly box office and the home cinema roundup featuring the trip to Spain. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the show and go into a listener question. This comes from our good friend Thomas from Seattle. Here's what he had to ask.
I was wondering if you were a promising director who had like one or two small indie films under your belt and Marvel or Star Wars came calling and said, hey, we want you to direct this next movie in our series of movies. Would you do that? I know like Star Wars and Marvel probably offer a big payday, but it seems like once you've kind of entered the machine, then instead of having like a directing career with like maybe some sort of little vision for each film, your career path is just now a studio journeyman director. And, you know, granted with probably a really nice payday and more certainty in life, but would that be a route you would take, or is that sacrificing of like artistic voice something that some of these younger directors who are offered these gigs should think about?
You know, this is an interesting question because I find it curious where Hollywood picks and how they pick some of these directors, because some of this stuff has worked out great. Sometimes pulling somebody from the independent world has become incredibly well. I mean, look at what happened with Jurassic World. You got Colin Trevorrow, who did that movie, Safety Not Guaranteed. Not a big movie, but a cute little clever film. And then he does Jurassic World, which made $580 quadrillion. All right. It made $200 million. It was like that second movie to make $200 million that nobody expected to make that much money its opening weekend. And we've seen it happen also with a person like Taika Waititi, who did Thor Ragnarok. I mean, this guy has done smaller little films that in New Zealand. I mean, not a big name. And to that wit, you know, you had somebody like Peter Jackson doing smaller little films in New England. And then he got tapped to do the Lord of the Rings movies and ended up doing the Hobbit movies. He did six movies about with a budget of like $1 billion total. So it does work out really, really well. Or you'll see somebody who maybe has directed some stuff, but has a much bigger career in like television, like Joss Whedon, who his movie Serenity, it was not a big hit, but boy, they handed him the Avengers and it was incredible. So this does work out sometimes. That would be a reason to do it. And I think that some of these people I've named, I certainly think that Taika Waititi has kept his auteur nature. I think he's kept his independence by making this, and I don't think it would be odd for him to do something smaller. Joss Whedon certainly turned around and did Much Ado About Nothing, and then, of course, did the next Avengers movie, and then did cleanup work on Justice League. So this does work, and people do go back to doing smaller stuff. There's nothing stopping them. Even, somebody like Colin Trevorrow went back and did The Book of Henry. But then sometimes this stuff doesn't work out. You're right, it doesn't. And sometimes it's a disaster. Like, look at what happened to David Fincher. He was plucked from music videos, not really doing anything given the Alien franchise. And it was a disaster from beginning to end. He couldn't get the movie he wanted made, and he was a pain in the butt. And so there are people that it doesn't work out for. Or look at Josh Trank. Oh my God, somebody who had the most promising career because he had a movie like Chronicle under his belt, which already dipped its toe into the superhero genre. And then it was a nuclear explosion of problems with Fantastic Four. Or you have movies that kind of fall through. you know, somebody like Edgar Wright. He agreed to do Ant-Man, and he didn't get the movie being made that he wanted to make and got kicked off the project. And part of it was because I think he was pushing back from stuff that happened with Scott Pilgrim. The same thing happened with Colin Trevorrow getting booted from the Star Wars franchise, or the guys who were doing the Solo movie before Ron Howard stepped in. So this stuff happens. You can get booted off, but that's okay. It's better than going in and ruin your career. I mean, look at like someone like Mark Webb. He did the Amazing Spider-Man movies after doing independent romances, and those weren't the best. They just kind of, we're just there. And there have been huge problems with that never worked out. Brett Ratner trying to do a Superman movie, Peter Berg doing Battleship, but Zack Snyder, who certainly got his start doing smaller movies, he's kind of made a mess for himself in the DC Cinematic Universe. Or look at Martin Campbell, who's well-known director, who had done movies like Casino Royale, and then he did Green Lantern, and it was an absolute bust. I would do it. If I were a young director and had promise, I would certainly do it, because it's worked in the past, and you just gotta not look at it as completely changing your game. You got to just say, well, I'm working with a budget of $150 million versus a budget of $1.5 million, and look at it differently. It's sort of like, you know, can Michelangelo paint a portrait, you know, on a 5x7 canvas? Absolutely, they can paint something, and then you can paint something like the Sistine Chapel. You know, I mean, there are, you can scale your art, you can scale your talent for different projects. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the box office. Not a whole lot really to talk about this week because, there were just very small movies. I mean, Just Getting Started was the only new one last week, and it barely made the top 10 with $3.2 million. Coco three-peated with 18 and a half, and Justice League was at 10. Now, Justice League is actually doing fine. Going back to something, I kind of took a couple digs this week against the DC Cinematic Universe, but it's doing fine. I had heard that the magic number of it making its money back was $570 million. It's well over $600 million internationally, so it's doing fine. Again, we don't need to have bake sales for Warner Brothers for that movie. It's just not going to be a huge cash cow that The Avengers was. But this week, of course, Star Wars is going to destroy everything. We're going to have massive numbers, and just look for that to rule the box office for the next couple weeks. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is on a smaller film. I actually covered it earlier this year, just a couple months ago when it was in theaters, and that is The Trip to Spain. It's being released by Shout Factory on DVD and Blu-ray, so you can catch it at home in the comfort of your own home, which is kind of a fun way to watch these movies because this is one of those films that kind of has a smaller, limited release. It's not exactly a big movie, and you were lucky if it came to your hometown. It may not have. If you don't have a whole lot of cinemas, or you don't have a independently minded cinema, or one that shows smaller movies that isn't going to sell out, one that's not just going to give the extra screen to Marvel or Star Wars or the Justice League or anything like that, this is a fun little movie. It's the third in the series with Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, and they have done the movie The Trip, and they did The Trip to Italy, which were two films about them going across the countryside. And like I said, they sort of play themselves. And in this one, this is the third in the series, and they play exaggerated versions of themselves traveling across Spain to do restaurant reviews and offer irreverent comedy.
Rob, Steve Coogan. Just got back from filming in New York.
They want me to do publicity.
A series of restaurant reviews. This time, a trip to Spain.
Yes, I will come.
The thing about doing more,
yes,
less is more.
you've met my brother Les.
Come, Mr. Bond. You enjoy the scallop just as much as I do.
Bottoms up.
Goodbye, Mr. Bond.
The first two films are very charming. Actually, my favorite of all three is probably The Trip to Italy, because I think that's the one that's the broadest from a comedic standpoint. The first one's rather dry, which is fine, because, hey, it's a British movie, and you expect that from a British film. But this one's a little more self-referential, because it is mostly playing off of the fact that Steve Coogan was nominated for an Academy Award for writing, and he was also in, of course, the movie Philomena, which starred Judi Dench several years ago. And it's him, as always, these exaggerated versions of themselves. He's the cad in this one. And in the second movie, in the first and second movie, it's more Rob Brydon, who's philandering around during his trip and not being good to his family. But it's really Steve Coogan who's kind of going through the midlife or later midlife crisis, because I think he's turning 50 in this movie. And this is just fun to watch two very good, dry wit, but bitingly fierce comedians go at it and have a good time with each other, doing this sort of travelogue across Spain. And, you know, when you listen to the trailer, as weird as that trailer plays, it is a way the movie is, because the movie is sort of a scattershot of a whole bunch of different references, because it's just them having random conversations, but they're so funny in the process of doing it that it works. And this one also has an interesting conclusion. It's worth checking out if you haven't seen it. If you've seen The Trip or The Trip to Italy, check out The Trip to Spain. And if not, go ahead and check out The Trip to Spain, because these are fun movies, especially if you have a love of Steve Coogan's humor or just the dry wit of British humor. So I'm going to have to say that The Trip to Spain kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Other movies that are coming out this week on DVD and Blu-ray include Kingsman, The Golden Circle, Detroit, Home Again, and Game of Thrones Season 7. And that is it for this week. Next week is the Big Fat Christmas Special, and I'm going to talk about, of the billions of movies releasing on Christmas, I'm going to be talking about Downsizing and Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, and some best and worst Christmas movies. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.